When Toby Barlow set out to write his first novel, Sharp Teeth, he knew he wanted to tell a story about love and werewolves in modern Los Angeles. But why did he choose to write it in free verse?
It's a tricky one to explain. You do have to get rid of, you know, a lot of initial resistance from people who just kind of roll their... I mean, I had a hard time getting friends to read this.
As Rick Kleffel from member station KUSP explains, Sharp Teeth pays homage to both Homer and monster movies. It's an epic love story, as well as a bloody tale of struggles for power.
On the cover, the black silhouette of a dog with silver fangs snarls against a blood-red background. Inside, the stark simplicity continues as the story is told in free verse. Toby Barlow begins with a heroic portrait of a thin, brown-skinned man wearing a T-shirt.
The first lines I wrote of the book are the first lines in the book, which are, you know, let's sing about that man there.
Specifically, let's sing about the man there at the breakfast table, an unemployed resident of East L.A. who will soon find a job in the classifieds as a dog catcher.
And to me, it was a bit of a tongue-in-cheek joke and reference to Homer. I'm a huge fan of the Iliad. I'm an enormous fan of the Odyssey. So it seemed to me a worthy ambition to say, let's sing about something else. Let's sing about the dog catcher. So it's a song of a common man in a very uncommon situation.
Barlow says it was an actual dog catcher, the subject of a newspaper profile, that inspired him to write the book.
He mentioned that the dog catcher mentioned that dog packs are made up of gangs of male dogs surrounding a single female dog. And I thought, wow, if that pack of dogs were actually werewolves, and if that female dog fell in love with that dog catcher, that could be really kind of an interesting social phenomena.
Barlow's interest in the social lives of werewolves gave him an emotional anchor while writing. Though it started as a love story, Sharp Teeth developed into a vision of downward economic mobility and homelessness. Once, when Barlow was driving in East L.A. with a friend, they encountered a surreal scene he'd recall in the book.
Under an overpass, pack of about 70 dogs went roaming through the streets. And I was completely blown away because we were in the middle of, you know, one of the world's biggest cities. And here were all these dogs.
The rival gangs who turn into wolf-like dogs and Sharp Teeth have different strategies as they plot to gain territory and power. Allegiances and positions within the pack change along the way. Jennifer Barth at HarperCollins became Barlow's editor for the book.
Toby's agent is a woman I've known for many years, and we were having lunch, and she said, I've got this book for you. She had brought it along, the manuscript, and said, you're either going to love it or you're going to hate it.
Barth took the manuscript home and started reading it that night. She says that Sharp Teeth is not a horror novel, even though most of its main characters are monsters.
They're not your grandmother's werewolves. They are, you know, the full moon has nothing to do with their change. Much of the time, they take the form of men.
And if you kill, kill the unmournable, deserters, wanderers, rustlers, rum runners, drug dealers, men who will never be missed. Life goes on. The light asks little from those who send the darkness away.
When it came time to edit the manuscript, Toby Barlow says the unusual format proved to be an advantage.
Actually, the style that I'd written was great, I think, for a first novel because the fat and the meat are so easily separated in a form like this.
We probably went through about six passes, and the first pass, we sat and we talked about the book sort of on the macro level before I delved in with on-the-page comments.
Between them, Barth and Barlow cut down the original manuscript significantly. The free verse may at first look unfamiliar, but it's comfortable to read. Editor Jennifer Barth views the unorthodox format as an asset.
No matter how many books you've read this year, last year, in the past decade, you can guarantee that you have not read anything like Sharp Teeth. That, to me, in this crowded marketplace, in this failing environment for readers, we're told, is the best hook you could give.
Toby Barlow describes Sharp Teeth as a ripping yarn with the extra words ripped away.
I like to think of it more as being a graphic novel without any pictures or a pot boiler that's a hard-boiled novel that's been boiled down to just a reduction sauce.
And the concise free verse of Sharp Teeth might look invitingly familiar to fans of graphic novels. But short lines and fewer words per page quicken the pace while giving any reader room to breathe. For NPR News, I'm Rick Kleffel.
You can read an excerpt of Toby Barlow's novel on our website, npr.org. Dogs are big in the publishing world these days. Just ask NPR's Lynn Neary. She's been collecting books about dogs for months now.
I can't say exactly when the dog books started piling up in my cubicle, but at some point the stack reached critical mass. So I thought it might be fun to rummage through them with an expert.
So Joe Garden, I have a huge pile of books here. I'm about to empty it out onto this. I don't know if you can hear all those books.
It sounds like a great volume of books.
It's a fair, you know, it's a pretty good pile, and every single one of these books has a dog on the cover.
Joe Garden is one of the authors of The Dangerous Book for Dogs, a work of sheer marketing genius, combining as it does two publishing phenomena, the best-selling dangerous books for boys and girls and books about dogs. Garden would like you to believe his book was merely ghostwritten by him and several other humans, but actually written by who else? Dogs.
Rex and Sparky were the authors, and it was the author's decision to dedicate this book to Marley.
Marley the dog, for those of you who've been paying very little attention to the book world of late, is the subject of the wildly popular book Marley and Me. One obvious reason for its success, apart from anything else, is that it has an irresistible dog on the cover. And if you don't like dog books, says Joe Garden, blame Marley.
Frankly, Marley kicked the door down and allowed everybody else, all the rest of us, to come in with our dog books and dog book ideas.
Just to give you a sense of what Garden's talking about, here are just a few of the titles.
Rescuing Sprite, A Dog Lover's Story of Joy and Anguish, Anna Quinlan's Good Dog Stay, John O'Hurley, Oh, Before Your Dog Can Eat Your Homework, First You Have to Do It. I mean, they just go on. Pause and Effect, that's one of my favorite, P-A-W-S and Effect, The Healing Power of Dogs. Lots of lessons, apparently, to be learned from dogs. But that's where Joe Garden draws the line. Dogs are cute, playful, loyal, but wise?
I think that if you are looking to your dog for answers so desperately, I really think you should probably find religion at that point.
That's my dog. Her name's Jazz, short for Jasmine. I'm crazy about her. Well, okay, the bark can be a little annoying, but I really do love her. She's one of those designer mutts, you know, part poodle, part cocker spaniel. I think she'd look pretty cute on the cover of a book. And I don't care what Joe Garden says, I've learned a lot from Jazz. Nothing I want to share with you at the moment. I'm saving it for my book. I think I might put my daughter on the cover, too.
Come here, girl. Good dog. Yes, you are. Come here.
Who could resist that book? Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is Weekend Edition. I'm Leanne Hansen. Today is Easter Sunday, the most important holy day in the Christian tradition. At the Vatican, Pope Benedict delivered his annual message and blessing. When the current pontiff's predecessor, John Paul II, died in 2005, Suzanne Strempick Shea had a revelation. Although raised Roman Catholic, Shea felt a disconnect from her church and was amazed by the passion and devotion shown by mourners at Pope John Paul's wake. It inspired a pilgrimage. Shea decided to visit a different Christian church every Sunday for a year, and she began on an Easter Sunday. Suzanne Strempick Shea joins us from member station WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts. Welcome. Happy Easter.
Happy Easter, Leanne. Thank you.
Tell us about that first Easter Sunday service at the new Mount Zion Church in Harlem, New York.
Well, it really was my destination for the morning because it was going to be so different from the service that I normally would attend, which would be a very early, very pomp-filled, procession-filled Polish-American Catholic Mass. So when I wanted to start this book on Easter Sunday, I thought I would choose a place that was very different from that. And I had a cousin that had toured some churches in Harlem and gone to listen to the music and to some services, and she just was really overcome by this one particular church, New Mount Zion, and she said, you must go there. And my husband and I took the train, and there we were in a very different town than my Western Massachusetts home village. We were in a church that was very loud all of a sudden when we walked in. There was music and drum beating, and people were just having the most wonderful time physically, which I was not used to, certainly in Catholic Church, you just enter and kneel down and that sort of thing. And here was, I'd say, about 2.5 hours of just really outwardly joyous celebration.
How did you decide which churches to visit? I know you wanted to stay with Protestant denominations, but how did you actually narrow it down?
Well, I started with the Protestant. I wanted to explore the rest of Christianity other than Catholicism. You know, I didn't have a lot of money for this for the travel budget, so I tried to make it as economical as possible. So let's say if I heard that Southwest Airlines was having a sale to Omaha, I'd look up and say, well, what's the predominant religion in Omaha? Lutherans. I haven't been there yet. So I visited the Lutherans. And you know, it was some were hung on hooks, like for Christmas Eve, Sunday, I went to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, because I thought, well, I should, you know, venture to Bethlehem for Christmas time. And for Halloween time of the year, I went to a spiritualist church in Boston that includes the deceased in the worship. And so, you know, some of them were specifically for a time of year, and others were just because I could get a good deal.
You also attended some that seemed to be unusual. What would you consider to be the most unusual service you attended?
Well, I really did love the one I mentioned, the spiritualist church, because for most of the worship, I was the only person seated in the sanctuary. There was the doorman who stayed behind me standing, who would let me in, and the pastor. But I had this wonderful experience of just trying to imagine all those who had passed on sitting around me and my deceased dogs on the floor at my feet. And it was really a beautiful experience. And I loved that. And this was not the spiritualist church was not something that I had even known of before.
Although you said you wanted to attend Protestant services in Protestant denominations or other than Catholic, because that was the faith that you were brought up in and you were familiar with it. But you did go to a Catholic service in Baltimore.
Well, it's actually called the New Catholic Church, mm-hmm. and it is one of several that I visited that is aimed at a lot of people who don't feel comfortable in a traditional Catholic church. They are opening their arms and their doors to people of a lesbian, bi, gay, transgendered community. But it was just such a lovely experience of community, and I didn't know anyone there. I just felt so welcome. And that was the great thing about a lot of these churches. No one asked me for my membership card on the way in. I was just, you know, made to be part of the gang. And that was a great thing Sunday after Sunday, most of them, I'd say.
What did you discover about faith in America?
Well, the wonderful thing is that we can have it. And, you know, certainly any day of the year, you can make your long list of what's wrong with this country or any other. But on the list of what's great about it is if you want to become, you know, a UCC member, or if you want to...
That's United Church of Christ, yeah.
Exactly. Or if you want to say, I'm going to go every Sunday morning and stand by that tree in my front yard and think good thoughts, that's my religion. That's wonderful. This is not a country in which you are forced to pay tithes to anything. You're forced to become a member of something. You know, what I'm finding is that people, you know, we can get together and worship. We do get together and worship. It's a wonderful thing that I have this in my head, sort of a slideshow that any given Sunday morning, there are millions of people in a small church on a reservation, in a very remote church, in one of the towns ravaged by Hurricane Katrina, in Times Square, in a church that used to be a giant show hall, you know, things like that. You know, we're all gathering and we're praying to the God that we think is the God, and we're asking and we're thanking. And it's just, I think it's a real beautiful thing.
Suzanne Strumpik-Shea is the author of Sundays in America, published by Beacon Press, and she joined us from the studios of WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts. Thank you, Suzanne.
Thank you so much, Leanne.
For decades now, the writer John Marks has been obsessed with Bram Stoker's Dracula. He even tried telling his own version of that story in his novel. It was called Fang Land. And today in our series, You Must Read This, he tells us why the Dracula story still captivates him.
One spring around Easter, I went to Transylvania, a place I had been dreaming about ever since childhood. I was there to write about the publication of Bram Stoker's Dracula in Romania, where Transylvania is located. In reality, I was a pilgrim. Like tens of thousands of others, I had been drawn to the region by a work of fiction. Transylvania more than lived up to Stoker's depiction, a mountainous country populated by farmers who traveled by horse-drawn wagon, shadowed by ancient castles. People I interviewed told me they still believed in demons, including a version of the vampire. In the midst of that glorious spring, blood-colored Easter eggs peeked out of homemade baskets. Stoker's novel had come alive. But then for me, in a way, it always had been. I love Dracula. Written in the form of letters, journal entries, phonograph recordings, and newspaper clippings, Dracula always seemed more real than other books. It was like a collection of unearthed evidence, a reporter's dream. And yet the story told by the documents was impossible, unreal, fantastic. Could there ever be an undead count who sucked the blood of the living, whose victims then died and rose again? That's the great tension of the book, the struggle between rational fact and supernatural reality. And for that reason, Dracula has always embodied a central struggle of my life, always poised on the brink of belief. At the age of 16, I became a born-again Christian. I began to believe in my own redemption through salvation by Jesus Christ, a man who shed his blood for my sins and came back to life. In a funny sense, Dracula laid the groundwork for my conversion. In the novel, people die and come back to life, but they return to a universe of darkness and cruelty, to an undead state that is the opposite of the kingdom of heaven. It is the flip side of the Easter story, resurrection as damnation. My faith has waned over the years, but I know I haven't finished with the struggle between the rational and the supernatural, because I go back to Dracula and find myself riveted yet again by the book's exquisite balance between the visible and invisible worlds. You might say I live by the words of the novel's metaphysician and scientist, Abraham Van Helsing, who explains the meaning of the vampire to one of the book's characters in this way. You are too prejudiced. Do you not think that there are things which you cannot understand, and yet which are? That some people see things that others cannot? There are always mysteries in life. Spring and its spectacle of natural rebirth recounts that mystery. So does the story of the resurrection. It may sound ridiculous, but in its own way, the tale of Dracula also gets at the same thing, its sadness, its exaltation, its haunting poignancy. I ask myself, how can we bear to live in a world that is all fact, in which every answer can be tallied up like a mathematical equation? And at the same time, how can we risk giving ourselves over entirely to the indefinable, the unseen? Caught forever in the space between those questions, I always find the vampire waiting for me with his riddles.
John Marks, the author of Fangland and Reasons to Believe. For an excerpt of Bram Stoker's Dracula and more You Must Read This recommendations, go to NPR.org. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Noah Adams. Major League Baseball gets off to its spring start next week, and if you are standing in the beer line and want a lighthearted argument, try this one. Abner Doubleday, forget about him. The writer, Peter Morris, disposes with Doubleday very quickly in his new book. It's called But Didn't We Have Fun? It's the story of how baseball began in America. 1862, for example, was an important year. Brooklyn built an enclosed field. That meant you could charge admission, pay the players. Before that, Morris says, baseball was just in the air and out in the fields.
The really fascinating story that doesn't get talked about enough is that baseball was understood as American pastime in the 1820s and 1830s, but it was a child's game. And by 1870, it's a professional sport. If I were to tell you that hopscotch was going to be a professional sport in 30 years and men would earn a living playing hopscotch, you would laugh and you would say, well, that's ridiculous. But that's exactly what happened with baseball. And to me, that's really a more fascinating story than the more conventional one in which, you know, somebody invents baseball one day and it grows in popularity.
They called it round town in different places. And I like the idea of, in the old days, you used to hit the runner with the ball to make him out.
A lot of people thought that was the best part of early baseball, was that what the fielders did is instead of throwing to some baseman or tagging a base, they would throw the ball at the base runner. And if they hit him, he was out. And if they didn't, they'd just keep pegging at him until they hit him. And probably the biggest problem with that, and the biggest reason that had to change, is that in order to play that way, they had to use a really soft ball and kind of reinforce the idea that this was a child's game.
Right. And then you have the very elegant men of the Knickerbockers Social Club in New York City. They're wearing white flannel shirts, blue wool pantaloons so they can run more easily. They're wearing straw hats. And they figure that you're going to have some rules. This would be in 1845, do I have that right?
Yeah. They were really a social club having fun. And they had no thought that their game would spread. And most of their rules, when you look at them carefully, you can deduce that they were just worried there were too many people were showing up and it was hard to fit them in. So a lot of their rules were not with any intention of forming a professional sport, but just so that the fun wasn't ruined by having people who felt like they'd been left out and should be playing, or who felt that they could show up late and just start playing at any point.
Kind of a hero here, Daniel Adams of the Knickerbockers, who said, "I went all over New York to find somebody who would undertake this work," the work being making a baseball, making a real baseball. He finds a Scotch soldier to do it, to sew it up, and then he uses a shoemaker later on to make what is, I guess, the precursor of the modern baseball.
Right, and those are the people who should be heroes in the history of baseball, not Abner Doubleday, but Daniel Adams, who really worked on the practical necessity of having a good baseball that would stay together. And there really should be a monument in some ballpark to the unnamed Scotch soldier who helped him put together a baseball that could actually last and be used.
Now, how does the game get out of Manhattan and out to the countryside, out to the other states?
It really follows, a period where America is going through this dramatic transformation from being a rural society to a modern industrial country where people are moving about. And so, first of all, New Yorkers start taking their game. And then the second big transmitter of the new rules, the new way of playing baseball, were college students. They'd go off to college and they'd find this new game being played at their college campus. And they'd come home at the end of their education, or they'd come home for the summer, and they'd bring the game back with them.
Yeah, but you pose this as a question. Why give up this freedom they have to play their own way, in order to conform to some rules formulated by a bunch of New Yorkers?
All of a sudden, you could play games against the team in the next city over. You could challenge them, and you could make it a huge expedition. The whole community would go to this town 30 miles away. Now, 30 miles away doesn't sound a lot now, but in the 1860s, that was a big trip, and it was exciting to be able to go that far. The other major reason was that once they got rid of the rule where you could throw the ball at the base runners, they were able to play with these lively, rubbery balls, and batters started to realize they could hit the ball out of sight. You know, people think that Babe Ruth started the home run era. Well, actually, he brought it back. And in the 1860s, this is when Americans first discovered, wow, they could hit the ball out of sight. And so many of the accounts that I found for this book were of people talking about the guy who hit the home run over the church steeple, the guy who hit the home run into the river, the famous home run hit over the creek and into the woods. And one of my favorite accounts was in 1906, a distinguished professor of Greek at the University of Michigan passed away. And he had all these accomplishments as a professor. He had helped to hire Fielding Yost as a football coach at Michigan and been part of the athletic department. He'd done all these things. And his obituary, one of the main things in his obituary was he hit the longest home run ever seen at the University of Michigan.
That's great. So it was pretty exciting back then. I want to ask you about this issue, and that is the first enclosed field. This was in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And you had the first luxury box. What was that luxury box?
Yeah, the first enclosed stadium in Brooklyn, they had a very novel type of luxury box, and it was right actually out in center field. It was a little pagoda out behind the center fielder, and it was far away that only a few batters would ever hit the ball out there, but it was actually in the field of play. And so these first spectators who paid a little extra, got a meal for their luxury box, they were actually in the field of play, and theoretically the ball could come out and do it. It was a novel experience.
Sounds like something you could try today.
It does. It sounds remarkably like something that somebody might do today.
You quote a sports writer named Henry Chadwick, who I believe is the only sports writer still in the Hall of Fame, Baseball Hall of Fame?
That's correct, yeah.
He wrote this in 1889 about a club that played 30 years earlier, before admission was charged and before people got salaries, back when people were having fun with baseball. Would you read, please, what Mr. Chadwick wrote sort of nostalgically about something that happened before?
Yeah, that was about a team called the Pastime Club that he was very fond of. And he wrote, "What jolly fellows they were at that time, one and all of them, and how fully they entered into the sport of the game. And truly were those meetings on the ball field in those days occasions well adapted to inspire good humor and gay spirits. For if there is any one thing, more than another, calculated to produce this kind of natural, happy feeling among kindred spirits, it is to take to bright green fields of a warm spring day and enter into a lively game of baseball. Just for the fun of the thing, you know."
That's Peter Morris reading the words of sports writer Henry Chadwick from 1889. Mr. Morris has written the book, But Didn't We Have Fun? An Informal History of Baseball's Pioneer Era, 1843-1870. Thank you, Peter Morris.
My pleasure, Noah.
And to hear how clumsy teams of amateur players, they were called muffins, saved the spirit of baseball, go to the website, npr.org.
This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Chadwick.
And I'm Alex Cohen. The cost of food is up, way up, everywhere from pizza parlors to your local grocery store.
And one reason for that is that the price of corn is up, about 50% from a year ago. When corn goes up, so does the price of a lot of other things that we buy regularly, because corn is in many of them, cereal and soda. And it's also used as feed for chickens and dairy cows.
And that's part of the reason the average price of eggs is up about 25%. Milk, 15% from a year ago.
As with anything, whenever producers' costs increase, they like to try to pass it on to the consumer as much as possible.
That's John Norris. He's the managing director of the Oakworth Capital Bank in Birmingham, Alabama. And why, you ask, is the price of corn so high? Well, one word, ethanol.
Here in this country, we make ethanol using corn. In other countries, they use other products. So there's a lot of speculation that corn prices are going to continue to go up. Apart from the speculation, we are producing more ethanol. So there's greater demand for corn, and that's causing their prices to go up as well.
So high corn prices and other factors in the rising cost of food. Higher gasoline prices, for one. Remember, food often gets shipped a long ways before it gets to our dinner tables.
And on top of that, a weak dollar means U.S. crops are in higher demand on the global market. And as I'm sure you know, when demand goes up, so do the prices.
So how can we deal with these high prices, those of us eating at home or anywhere else? Well, let's get out of the field of pure economics and into the realm of home economics.
These days, the idea of making a three-course meal for a family of four for less than $20 seems impossible. Unless, that is, you shop at the 99-cent only store. There are more than 200 of them throughout the West, and true to their name, everything there costs less than a dollar, including food. Christiane Jory is the author of an upcoming book called The 99-Cent Only Store's Cookbook. The idea may sound silly, but the book is filled with recipes for gourmet dishes like Gruyere beignets, salmon souffle, and Pinot Noir poached pear tarts. Curious and hungry, I went to visit Christiane at her home where she prepared this menu.
Chicken pot pies, which I'm really excited, individual chicken pot pies. We have a scalloped potato, which we're spicing up with roasted diced green chilies, and then a homemade apple pie.
It sounds delicious. It smells delicious. I think I can smell the apple pie. So talk us through this. How do you cook a 99-cent meal?
Okay, well, we're going to start. First, I want to take the pie out of the oven because I planned it just so it'd be ready. I went this morning. I had planned on cooking little tartlets, but they had pie crust, frozen pie crust. And I've had these Fuji apples I bought last week that are canned, and I thought, oh, there's got to be a way. And then, of course, I always go online because they didn't have nutmeg, but it's so easy. You just go nutmeg substitute, and there's a zillion suggestions. So I added, of course, cinnamon, but then instead of nutmeg, there's a little ginger, a dash of clove.
It sounds like there's a lot of improvisation involved when you do the 99-cent cooking thing.
Yeah, there has to be. When I started cooking this book, they didn't even have milk. So you'd get evaporated milk and then add water, you know. You just have to be really flexible. But there's so many ways. You got to think outside the box.
For example, the crusts on the chicken pot pies, they came from a can of refrigerated Pillsbury biscuits, rolled out thin and layered into ceramic dishes known to chefs as ramekins.
10 biscuits will definitely, if you use some elbow grease, will give you your 4 pies. If you want to cut down on calories, you can just cover it with a biscuit, but it's so good with a biscuit all around. And you butter the ramekin so they pull away really nicely.
Oh. For the filling, Christiane uses chicken from a can, spinach from a can, veggies from, yeah, you guessed it, and adds it to a base concocted of other 99-cent ingredients.
So I have dried diced onions, and what this is I soak them in the liquid from the can of mixed vegetables, which we're going to use. And then I added 3 tablespoons of wine, which, yes, I'm going to make you all try a sip before.
Is this
99-cent wine, which I bought, and I haven't opened it, and I'm glad, because now you're here and I needed it for this.
In fact, it was a bottle of discount wine that started Christiane's career as a truly frugal gourmet. She is not on the 99-cent store payroll, but she has been a loyal customer there for years. At first, she went just to buy sundries, but then one summer day a few years back, something happened.
I was broke, and I like my wine. And then I saw this woman buying wine, and I was like, no way. And she had fancy shoes on. I looked at her. She's like, it's really good. And so I was like, so that's when I bought. I was sitting on block, and I was like, I got wine for the summer, thank God. And that was when I started thinking, maybe there's food here, too.
Turns out there was lots of food, most of it brands she hadn't heard of before, or in boxes that were slightly misshapen or discolored. But what was inside tasted just fine, she says. And with a bit of creativity, Christiane realized 99-cent ingredients could turn into truly delicious dishes.
I'm really hoping that people are going to use this as an opportunity. I think the economy is going so downhill. And I think there's a way to just kind of keep a smile on your face and find cheap ways to still have fun. I hate it when people say, oh, I don't have money, so I can't do anything.
How much culinary expertise do you need? Is it good to have some basic cooking backgrounds before you take on the 99-cent cuisine?
Why? You know, if you screw it up, what? You, like, lost 99 cents or $5? I mean, that's money. I'm not saying that that's not important, but, God, when I used to cook and when I lived in New York, it's like, if I screwed up, it was $30 down the drain.
Many of Christiane's recipes come from her own imagination. Others are adaptations from culinary classics like The Joy of Cooking and the Moosewood Cookbook. She says she realizes the low-budget nature of her book may not be appetizing to all palates. The 99-cent price tag does have a bit of a stigma.
I feel the same way sometimes. I'm a snob, I'll admit it. And so, you know, sometimes if I cook it, I'm like, oh, I'm pulling the ham out of the can. I don't know.
And maybe it's a ham, maybe it's not.
Yeah, so my friends come over, I'm like, here, eat it, it's great. But I don't know if I'm going to eat it, or I'll wait to hear if they like it.
With that warning, I sat down to my meal. The pot pie looked like something Martha Stewart whipped up. And served in her mother's best china, Christiane's potatoes au gratin with green chilies could have been an expensive appetizer at a fine restaurant. Oh my gosh, that's really good. It's kind of got like that Tex-Mex flavor to it.
I think if you don't add the chilies, I think the chilies just give it that je ne sais quoi.
I ate the entire serving, most of the chicken pot pie and a slice of apple pie, all remarkably yummy. To top it off, we poured a glass of that 99-cent vino.
Fargy Bay American White Table Wine, cellared and bottled by Iron Oaks Vineyards. Do you want a toast?
Yes.
All right. Is this your first bottle of 99-cent oyster wine?
I think it is.
Oh my gosh, this is a huge day.
To cheap dining.
Thank you.
There is more on Christiane Jory's 99-cent only stores recipes at our website, that is npr.org. NPR's Day-to-Day continues in just a moment.